You were starring in a film. Come on, tell
us. I was.
It's
called Extraordinary.
You're dying to tell us.
I'm really not. It was very humbling. Last week before I went to see it, it's like, you know, my first time in a movie and everything. I was like, my life is about to change.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. No changes at all. I came back. My dog has a sick stomach. I'm just like, great. I'm home. It's fine. Anyway, I did all the talking there. I shouldn't have been. Does everybody sound okay? Okay, great. So let's kick it off. And we'll do a bit of chit chat and then we'll introduce you, Mihaela. Okay. Oh, good call, Tamale. She said, can you do an Irish accent?
Really?
No, I'm just kidding.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Mothers of Invention.
Yes, you're so welcome. That was Mary Robinson, the first female president of Ireland, current chair of the Elders, former UN High Commissioner on Human Rights. She makes me say all this stuff, you know, she insists.
And that's Maeve Higgins, writer and comedian, who's now a film star.
Yes, well, thank you, Mary. Okay. We are the hosts of Mothers of Invention, introducing our listeners to the inspirational women.
And maybe one or two men we've had already.
We have. We're very inclusive. All of these people are working on new and innovative ways to understand and address climate change all over the world. We hear their fascinating stories of ingenuity and perseverance.
And so in this episode, we look at what it means for us to move away from the energy sources we've been so dependent on, the fossil fuel. We dig into the concept of just transition, which connects Indigenous knowledge to the labour movement. And we'll have a broader approach to just transition. It's not just about the workers and their communities that have to move from the fossil fuel industry.
This is definitely an area that I've got a lot to learn. But Mary, we have drafted in an expert. Let's introduce our incredible host mother, who's joining us from the Navajo Nation. Welcome, Mihaela Johns.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming to New York for the record.
No, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you here, Mihaela.
Thank
I'm really
you for
looking forward to our conversation. What do you think of this Irish humour that you're exposed to at the moment? I mean, can you kind of relate to it?
Yes. I mean, I think most Native people are really humorous.
Good.
And so, yeah, I love to laugh. And I laugh all the time.
Great.
For me, like, I'm a comedian, so that's what I do anyway. But it's really interesting that you say that too.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm right in saying that you're from a part of the Navajo?
Navajo
Nation, which is considered northern Arizona by many people in the United States. So can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what it was like?
Sure. I grew up in northeastern Arizona on the Navajo Reservation. And actually, it's about the size of, they say, West Virginia or the size of Ireland.
Wow.
And that's how we've been able to explain the landmass that we have.
So like with Ireland, I know it's about 5 hours to drive from top to bottom.
Oh yeah, it is about the same.
And the native population?
The native population there, we have about, I think, 350,000.
Mm-hmm.
I would say maybe less than 200,000 that live on the Navajo Reservation. Yeah, and we have 110 communities, and it goes into Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona, so three states.
And what was your childhood like as regards like your sort of connection to the environment?
Most families that live on the reservation grew up in really rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up in Black Mesa region and went to school in dormitories, our boarding schools. And that was the kind of only schools that we had growing up. And so there'd be extended periods where I wouldn't see my relatives. And I don't know if you're familiar, but most, you know, historically, through treaties and through agreements with the U.S. government, Native nations had to comply to go to school or send their children to school.
Right.
And so a lot of times they were taken to boarding schools. And when I grew up, when I was little, that's the only type of school that was available. So
I didn't know that was so recent.
It is very recent, and now we have public schools, so it's, but, you know, that this is the upbringing, and but the way of life that we have there is my grandma raised sheep, cattle, and horses, and we didn't have running water, and we still don't, and we also didn't have electricity.
It's interesting that it was your grandmother who was doing the livestock husbandry.
Yeah, we come from a matrilineal society. Our nation is rooted in that. And
And do you have electricity now?
My grandma now has electricity, but where I live, I do not. But I get my electricity through off-grid solar.
Good. Yeah. I think it's great that you have your own electricity. We'll come back to that. But, you know, what disrupted your life and, you know, made things difficult?
There has been this historic land dispute between the Navajo and Hopi tribal nations. And what I learned was the natural resources that we sit on is actually kind of the main rooted cause of division in our communities. And the resources that we live on is coal and water.
Yeah.
And, you know, I quickly had to learn about my own history. This is something like I couldn't find in books. It was actually lots of narratives from grandmothers from our communities that talked about how Peabody Coal Company came onto our reservation and explored for natural resource extraction.
When did that start?
They say that started in early 1900s. And actually, this is how our tribal nation was formed. It was to be able to sign oil lease agreements.
So before that, it was just, there wasn't like this kind of put on sort of a structure.
No, we had our own form of governance that was totally different than the governance that we have today, which is actually mirrored from the U.S. government.
So what was your reaction when you sort of started to untangle this huge history with like Peabody and your own nation?
I heard a lot from the elders. And I think that looking to the spiritual people in our communities was, for me, was like enlightening in that, you know, they would encourage me to understand my history and learn more about what's going on, because in the future, you know, we're going to be getting older and this is going to be your responsibility. And so, you know, I started asking questions to my parents, to different historians in the community, and come to find out the real history was that, you know, Peabody Coal Company basically came out and signed negotiation agreements with our tribal nation, leaving out the participation of local people in the region of how this massive industry would impact our land, water, our air quality for 50 years. And I think at the time when the community heard about this coal mining idea, they thought like it was a little, you know, cart of coal and like picks. I think that was their image. And turned out it wasn't. It was actually using, you know, dynamite to blast acres of lands and go deep into the earth and extract coal strip mining.
Yeah, I was looking at the statistics from like that time, and it was 3 million gallons of desert aquifer water a day to pipe its coal slurry, like across your country, across state lines.
Yeah.
How is that even possible?
So they needed a way to transport coal back in the 70s. And this was like the most absurd idea, to use precious groundwater, the Navajo aquifer, where they would take 3 million gallons of water every day, mix it with pulverized coal, and send it through a pipeline 300 miles away to generate power for California, Nevada.
So it wasn't even for, not that it would be okay if the power was used there, but it was just for a totally different, miles and miles away. So what did you do? How did you establish the Black Mesa Water Coalition?
So we live on a really beautiful aquifer beneath Black Mesa, pristine ice age water. You don't have to add or take anything away from it. And so this is the precious water that Peabody was using every day in their slurry operations. And we started to see the drying of our springs in the peripheral areas of the region. And that was what created a lot of, you know, activism, but also a lot of all communities, Navajo and Hopi, coming together. And we formed, as a young organization, formed the Black Mesa Water Coalition. And there was another organization that formed called Tuonejone Ane, out of this movement, which translation is beautiful water that speaks. We were shocked that these springs that we always give offerings to were drying up right before our eyes, you know, and that started to worry a lot of people. If we don't have water, we don't, you know, that's going to be something that is going to affect our future and our living out there. So we started to visit our tribal leaders to talk about protecting the Navajo aquifer.
So you weren't so much fighting a kind of air pollution from the mining. It was more the water.
It was all about the water because that's central to everything and all life.
Yeah.
And central to our identity as Indigenous peoples from that area that, you know, receive less than 7 inches of rainfall per year.
Right.
And water is so precious, you know.
And then it was shut down, right? The mine was shut down. I'm sure I'm skipping years of like incredibly intense work, but you did it.
Not just me.
You personally, you marched in there, you gave the foreman a piece of your mind.
It was a lot of efforts. Mm-hmm. And when we saw that it was going to shut down, that helped us to understand all of our role in this work. And we definitely started working on what's next.
How is your company, Native Renewables, filling the gap and playing a role in energy for your communities?
Well, 75% of the unelectrified homes in the United States are located on my reservation.
What?
Wow.
So we have designed an off-grid solar PV photovoltaic with battery storage unit to power homes in Navajo Nation.
Is it because there's very spaced out?
Yeah, really rural. Thousands of people don't have access to power.
How many people would you serve?
We would serve 15,000.
Very good. And in the house, what does this mean?
So it's enough to power a refrigerator, lighting, TV, cell phones, computers, basic needs.
Basic needs. Yeah.
And, you know, energy access is a human right.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I would love to work with you on this because 1 billion people in the whole world don't have access to power. And so when you don't have access to power, that limits your productivity of work and school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when I visit these families, these communities that, you know, have children that go to school, they're limited, you know.
To lights. Daytime.
Daytime. When the sun goes down, that's it. Or they spend a lot of money on gasoline generators, on propane, on kerosene. You know, and I think this is part of the just transition is like...
That's actually my passion, that we reach that 1 billion who never switch the switch for electricity, and that we get to the even bigger number, 2.3 billion, who still cook on dirty cook stoves, where we have the clean cook stoves that can be made available off-grid and dispersed in the way that you're describing that you've done. I mean, it's...
You teamed up with an engineer, like also from the Navajo Nation, another woman.
Yes, so it's amazing. And so we're mostly women-led. I mean, we are women-led organization, company, and all of our people have the experience.
Well, we're going to meet our next mother now. Ina Braverman is an Israeli entrepreneur who's taken on the challenge of harnessing wave power. We caught up with her in Paris, where she was attending the C40 Women for Climate Summit.
This conference was designed by C40 cities to bring us together. Mayors, business leaders, journalists, change makers.
If you don't know about C40, imagine 90 mayors from megacities all over the planet congregating like the Knights of the Round Table to fight for climate justice.
Gentlemen, sorry, but today it will be all about us, about women, because women and girls make up more than half the planet's population and they suffer more from climate change. This is why their leadership and participation is critical to solving this global crisis.
The conference held a Women for Climate Tech Challenge, which Ina Braverman actually won the day after we interviewed her. And you are about to find out why.
Every time that I go to conferences, all the attendants are men, and usually older men, because the energy sector is considered to be a very male-dominated sector. And every time I go to a conference room, people go, "Coffee, please," because they think if a woman is there, she must be somebody's assistant. As women, we see that only 2% of the world VC funding is being granted to women. We see that in politics, most of the people are men. We see that in the energy industry, most of the people are men. It can be a bit discouraging that this is the situation. And an event like this shows you that there are strong women, there are inspirational women. They put you in a different state of mind. It gives you the confidence and the support that you need to keep going. And I always say that the greatest renewable energy source is passion. So all of us women, we need to stick with our passion and we need to do what we want and pursue our dreams. Most of the people, they hear about pollution and they hear about climate change, but they don't experience it from firsthand. For me, for example, I had a very personal story with pollution. I'm Israeli, I live in Israel, but I was born in Ukraine. And 2 weeks after I was born, the Chernobyl nuclear reactor exploded, which was the largest nuclear disaster in history.
31 of the initial firefighters and plant workers died within days from acute radiation sickness. The toxicity of the radioactive cloud was equivalent to 400 Hiroshima atomic bomb explosions.
And I was one of the babies that got hurt from the explosion. I actually had a respiratory arrest and clinical death. Luckily, my mother, which is a nurse, she came to the crib on time. She saw that I'm all pale and blue and not breathing, and she gave me a mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on time and saved my life. I was a lucky baby, but many children of Chernobyl, they died, and still there are a lot of cancer, heart problems, respiratory problems in Ukraine and in surrounding countries because of that explosion. My first life, kind of, was taken away by a power station that was generating electricity with nuclear. Many countries are promoting nuclear as a safe and good solution. And still we have nuclear disasters. Just a few years ago, we had a nuclear disaster in Japan. I was really lucky. I was given a second chance in life, and I want to do something good with it. And this is why I'm so passionate about wave energy and renewable energy.
Could the movement of waves help us reduce our reliance on fossil fuel? Researchers are trying to channel this fierce and very challenging force of nature.
So EcoWave Power is a company that was established in 2011. Our company does clean electricity from ocean and sea waves. What's unique about our technology is that we were able to solve difficulties that other wave energy competitors were struggling with. Most of the wave energy companies, they decided to install offshore 4 or 5 kilometers to sea. And installation was very, very expensive because you need ships, you need divers, you need underwater mooring and underwater electrical cables. The second problem was that it would break down every few days because in the offshore you have waves of 20 meters and even higher. No insurance company agreed to insure it. And environmentalists were actually objecting because it was in the middle of the sea and the connections to the floor were disturbing the environment. We solved it by basically connecting to existing breakwaters, piers, and other types of structures. We don't connect to the ocean floor, we only connect to man-made structures, so we don't disturb the environment at all. So the price went down. Currently, our price is the same like solar energy, but we generate at least double the amount of energy because we also work at night. We don't have breakage problem for the system. It's fully insurable, 100% environmentally friendly. We're able to really change the world a little bit. Actually, wave energy can power an entire city. The density of water is 800 times greater than the density of air, which means you can produce much larger electricity amounts with much smaller devices. So I'll give you an example. Israel is a very small country. We have like 187 kilometers of coastline. We have a port called Ashdod. On this type of breakwater, we can install 50 megawatts. That's 50,000 households. That's a lot. So imagine greater countries, greater cities that has many ports. You can definitely power a whole city.
This is clearly working. I think that the future is bright, and the future, like the past, all those 6 million years ago, is in the power of the sea all around us.
I think that there are two main challenges right now. The first challenge is bureaucracy and lack of a regulatory framework, because wave energy is kind of the new kid in the block of renewables. There's not enough laws and policies for it. So that's one. And I think that the second problem is that all the first pioneers, let's call it, of the wave energy field, they went to the offshore. So they spent a lot of money and they had a lot of breakages. So they lost a lot of money. And it kind of created a bit of a fear from the wave energy field as a whole. So many times when I go to a meeting, people go, no, wave energy, stay away, stay away. If they come visit our facility in Jaffa Port or our facility in Gibraltar, then they get excited because they see it's very cost efficient and very simple and nothing would break down.
On behalf of the EU Commission and the EU Programme Secretariat in Gibraltar, I wish every success to EcoWave Power. May it expand and produce lots more renewable energy, and I hope that we're able to collaborate in future expansion of this project. Thank you very much.
I really would like to promote using clean sources, not only wave energy. I don't think wave energy alone can be 100% of a solution. We need to combine solar energy, wind energy, tidal energy, wave energy, everything together to get a 100% environmentally friendly world. We cannot be in a position that we don't take advantage of our renewable free energy sources. We do it from the sun, we do it from the wind, we will definitely do it from waves as well.
Amazing. What an incredible story Ina has. Like she reinvented wave power after she survived a nuclear disaster. It's incredible.
It is incredible. And you know, she's absolutely right about the potential of wave power. Mm-hmm. We should explore this much more in Ireland. Actually, she's also right that we need a combination of solar, wind, tidal and wave energy, geothermal, all to help us in the crisis we're in.
I think it's exactly, you know, the combination. Each area is different, and you know, there's more windy areas in the Midwest of the United States. There's more sunlight in the Southwest. Looking at your environment and seeing what combination works is great. And if you have the resources to support that and to get to less emissions, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. I know the term just transition from speaking about it with Rhianna Gunright, who was in our public opinion episode. Rhianna's a lead policy writer on the Green New Deal, so it's been taken seriously. It's rooted in Indigenous knowledge that teaches us how to like respect the land, but it's also been adopted by the global labour movement.
Sure. When you have a community that's, you know, dependent on extraction and revenues from coal, what does that look like when that starts to phase out? And what kind of investment will it take to be able to advance just transition in a way that's equitable for the workers, but also for the community, and that the corporations are also being held accountable for cleanup? Because a lot of times these corporations, you know, walk away. Even just to do the visioning, we had to go to our communities and say, like, what is our vision 50 years from now, 100 years from now? And I think that's what the holistic approach to just transition is talking about.
No, I agree. You know, we need to move to green, affordable, sustainable buildings, to zero waste systems, to reestablish Indigenous agricultural systems and ecosystems restoration, to really restore, you know, and put the carbon back into the soil.
Next, we have an amazing young activist who can tell us more about how Just Transition will affect women. She is the co-founder of Tierra Activa, which connects urban activists with Indigenous activists across Peru. Welcome, Mahandra Rodriguez Atta. Welcome.
Welcome, Mahandra.
Thank you.
Welcome,
thank
Mahandra.
You.
Roll your R's, Maeve.
Rodriguez Atta.
Rodriguez.
Lovely. Okay. Yeah, how are you doing? Where are you right now?
I'm at home right now in Lima, in Peru. I'm actually in my mom's house, which is also currently my house for now.
Oh, very good. Oh, I wish I could still live with my mom. You're lucky. I just like pay way too much money to live by myself in New York. It's a terrible idea. Okay, we're so excited to talk to you. I'd love for Wahela to jump in here. She's co-hosting the show with us.
Yeah, thank you. Mahandra, I'm grateful for your allyship to Indigenous peoples in Peru. How did you discover Indigenous peoples movements and what has it meant to defend them in Peru?
So actually 10 years ago was the first time that I went to a protest on my own. I went with my little camera that I had at the time and I was filming, and it was sort of the period of time when citizen journalism was becoming a thing. You know, it was YouTube was first starting and people were spreading the word.
And what was the protest? What were you protesting?
The protest was around the Bagua massacre. And so around that time, Peru had signed a free trade agreement with the United States. And the Peruvian government had passed legislation that made it easier for Indigenous lands to be privatized and to be sold off to mining and extractivist companies and projects. And indigenous peoples throughout the country went into protest, into mass protest, and specifically in the Department of Amazonas, which is in the northern Amazon in Peru. There were road blockades of hundreds of people, indigenous people, just armed with sticks, essentially, who were blocking the road and saying, you cannot pass, you cannot enter our territory. And the national government gave the order for police forces to come in.
On Friday morning, some 600 Peruvian riot police and helicopters attacked a peaceful indigenous blockade outside of Bagua. Eyewitness accounts indicate the police fired live ammunition and tear gas into the crowd.
And on the 5th of June, 33 people were killed, 10 of which were indigenous people, and over 200 people were injured, and almost 100 people detained. Because of the magnitude of what had happened, this was not in Lima, but this was on TV. This was definitely a defining moment for me. I went out to protest on the streets. It was thousands of people on the streets of Lima. We were tear gassed that day as well. I was 19 years old, and I just remember, you know, running down the road, couldn't see a thing, and all around me, people were crying from the tear gas, but also just out of impotence and frustration and rage, you know, just anger and sadness at what the situation was and the fact that it had led to this moment.
Wahela, when you hear about these protests and the put downs, and how does that resonate with you?
It's very similar. I mean, especially when it comes to high-level negotiations between governments and corporations. Mm-hmm. Usually the, you know, community people are left out, populations of indigenous peoples, low-income communities are left out. And this is what climate justice is all about, is that, you know, recognizing that the disproportionate impacts of climate, but also the role that industry has in the way that guides decisions and creates unrest, creates dispute and harm.
And sadly, we have a lot of environmental defenders, human rights defenders, defending the land or water rights mm-hmm. of their community who are killed. In 2017, there were 207 land and environmental defenders killed, according to Global Witness's report. And that number is going up each year. It's really very shocking.
Personally, I grew up in a household that luckily allowed me to travel a lot within Peru. My mom does anthropology work, and I've accompanied her to travel to rural areas and indigenous communities since I was pretty young. But I sort of realized that the urban environment that I had grown up in was not representative of the world. Peru is a highly centralized country. A third of the population lives in Lima and has migrated to Lima, to the capital city, because it's the place that has the access to health. It has the universities, the central government offices, sort of all the major services, and also work opportunities and educational opportunities are in the city. And the city historically has lived with its back to the rest of the country. And that is rural areas, that's the Amazon, and that's the Andes.
Could you tell us, like, how you know, your personal involvement as an activist, like the first time that you decided, like, I'm actually going to go out there and make my voice heard?
I was 24 years old when a group of friends and I co-founded Tierra Activa Peru. Tierra Activa Peru is a youth collective, even though we define ourselves as an activist collective now, not necessarily youth, as we transition into other moments in life. And also, you know,
it's not like when you turn 30, you get like kicked out of the collective. Everybody's like, we don't need you anymore.
Now we're intergenerational.
Okay, good.
We value intergenerational exchange and also define youth very broadly. We're all youthful in our energy, not necessarily in our age, even though I'm still young.
No, that's what happened to Black Mesa Water Coalition was like, we started to get older and we're like, okay, so we're not really youth-led now.
You found yourself with like a glass of wine at gatherings and you were like, wait a second, we're grown-ups. I wonder, you know what I love hearing about, Handra, is like, you're a non-Indigenous person, but you want to, you know, be an ally. So you see mm-hmm. your position sort of as more of a megaphone rather than like speaking for people. Could you explain that a little bit?
Definitely, definitely. And I would say not even a megaphone, but I would say that my role and the role of people in Tierra Activa who are based in Lima is to make sure that the stage is set up, that the microphone's in place, that mm-hmm. we've spread the word out that there are people in the crowd, and we don't want to be the ones on the stage. And we also want to make sure that people in the room are also representative. And so that's why we've really focused on organizing national activist gatherings with rural youth, indigenous youth, urban youth, who are involved in different activist movements who can all come together and find common ground.
I love that approach, letting the voices that are the real experts on the situation, who really know and whose voices need to be heard, need to inform people and need to create a real understanding. And I gather you also use the term system change. Can yes. you explain how that's different from just climate change?
Of course. So our founding motto is system change, not climate change, because we don't want to talk about just what we don't want, but we actually want to be focusing on what do we want to build, right? Climate change is the product of a broken economy. It's the product of a broken political system that doesn't represent us. It's the product of a broken set of cultural and social and even spiritual values. And so when we talk about buen vivir, what it means is the good life. Right? And the good life as grounded in spiritual, indigenous, Andean and Amazonian cosmovisiones or cosmovisions, ways of seeing the universe that, again, are focused on reciprocity, are focused on harmony with nature, with each other, and are focused on the collective.
I want that. That sounds incredible.
That does sound incredible. Yeah. Mahendra, so how can women benefit from a just transition and what kinds of innovation are being developed to help us get there?
Mm-hmm. That came mm-hmm. up very much yesterday. I was in the Commission on the Status of Women. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk about the importance of a gender just transition that takes into account the gender quota solution for women's unpaid care work and women's informal work. What do you think about that?
It's definitely about women being a part of the conversation and deciding what are we transitioning towards and who is involved. But I also think it goes beyond just, you know, having more women in renewable energy jobs, for example. If we want to transition away from a patriarchal system as well, then we have to talk about, you know, centering care and the sustainability of life and thinking about cultural and spiritual values and priorities that shake the roots and the foundations of the patriarchy. That is a just transition into a renewable, healthy, safe future.
Yes, Mahendra, you're speaking our language. That's amazing. You're so fantastic, Mahendra. Let us know, how can Mothers of Invention listeners support your work?
Definitely by finding out more about the work of Tierra Activa in Peru, in Bolivia, and in Colombia. There is so much happening in our territories in terms of fossil fuel extraction. And a lot of these corporations have headquarters in the global north, in the United States and in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, it's a part of our collective responsibility to be aware of what's happening and to recognize what our role is in ensuring that the continued exploitation of our resources and harm to the well-being of our people is stopped.
Keep up the good work, Mahendra.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for your solidarity.
I think there must have been something magic in the water in 1989 because Mahendra is 29. So was Rihanna Gunright, who did our show. So was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I myself am 29 right now. Mary, what were you doing when you were 29?
Well, I'd been in the Senate for quite a few years.
You were a senator.
So I was trying to promote family planning in Ireland and, you know, got a bit of kickback from bishops and things.
Mary.
But that was then.
That's incredible. That's incredible. With the labour movement adopting just transition, do you think they're getting it right, Uhela?
I love what Mahendra was talking about. It's all of the different intersections.
It's a holistic approach.
Just transition is different from every community. It's not just renewables. It's not just energy efficiency. It's up to the community. They have that right and they have that participation and input. I do think that it's a start of a conversation. When there's an industry in your backyard, you have to have those conversations around equity, justice, and liberation. Right. For us, living in unison with all the seasons and designing energy, food, water, housing, health, These are all part of the kind of ecosystem that we want to design and continue to advance so that we can modernize what that looks like as Indigenous peoples. And that's what we've been working on.
Tell us, how did the Navajo Green Economy Act come about?
Well, we wanted to see a diversification of our economy on Navajo Nation. We wanted to see how we can best support the homegrown projects and initiatives in our communities where people are raising sheep, animals, where we have a lot of wool, where we have a wealth of knowledge of sustaining ourselves. And how can we support these small entrepreneurs to continue their practice? You know, the amount of corn, diversity of corn here in the Americas is amazing. The seeds that they grow are heirloom seeds of corn, for example, that could be used in, you know, great restaurants or within Navajo as well.
And yeah, so that's the type of thing that you see written in small letters in a really fancy restaurant and you know you're going to pay extra for.
For this green economy approach, we were saying, well, we already have this existing way of life. How can we best support these farmers and ranchers? Let's create job training, workforce development, so that we can help them, you know, better their entrepreneurial skills to be able to market their, you know, their business and lift them up. You know, we formed this so that we could support what's like a hidden economy that's been working for, you know, people for generations.
And now you're one of the Navajo Green Economy Commissioners.
Yeah, it's a great honor that we actually were able to get this Navajo Green Economy Act and the commission supported by the Navajo Nation Council. It took about 18 months of, you know, legislation and going through community.
It's not like top down, like, here's what we're doing.
No. And a lot of our presentations had to be translated in Navajo, our own language, so that we get input from all generations, youth and elders. We wanted to have the backing of the people. And when we took it to our tribal council, you know, they had no choice but to pass it, even though the Navajo Nation is coal-based, oil-based, and extraction economy.
And so you don't want to be saying, we're going to take all this away.
We did not say that. Right. We did push for renewable energy. We did push for energy efficiency. You want good insulated home. You want good, you know, windows. So these are the energy efficiency weatherization upgrades you can do.
Yeah.
More insulation in your roof, for example.
These are green jobs.
These are green jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was really hard. We had to translate even what green jobs meant in our language, that this is something actually a part of who we are and is in line with our, you know, ancestral teachings, but also can be applied to today and the way we're living in our communities, and that we can create jobs. Right now, we have a high unemployment rate that's going up, you know, over 50%.
Really?
Yes. And like I said earlier, our economy is so dependent on coal extraction. Mm-hmm. So when we did talk about solar, for example, people, the nation felt threatened because it could be competitive. Talking about transition is really challenging.
Yes, but I do particularly like your very wise words on how we should approach just transition by envisaging that world we want to see, that we want to live in, that will be better for everyone.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming this distance to speak with us, Wahila, and with such wise words. Global leaders have a lot to learn from you. You are a fantastic leader and role model. All the best with your work. It's really terrific. And how can we learn more about what you're doing?
Well, we have a website, nativerenewables.com.
What about you? Do you use social media?
I'm not good at it.
You're better off.
I'm not good. I haven't got it down, but my co-founder, Suzanne, is, and she's wonderful.
You can learn more about Wahila, about Ina, and about Mahandra's projects, as well as the work of all our past mothers, on our website, mothersofinvention.online. Don't forget to write us and share the stories you're most inspired by, or nominate a mother that you think we need to know about. Or you can get in touch on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
Mothers Invent.
Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society, and it's made possible by the generous support of our partners, the Climate Justice Resilience Fund, the Compton Foundation, the Wallace Global Fund, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, and the European Climate Foundation, and of course, our loyal DRIP crowdfunders.
Our series producer is Thimali Kodikara. The executive producers are Jess Search and Beattie Finzi. Our audio producer and mixer is Anne Pope. Jada Sante is our researcher. Sara Rodriguez was our woman on the ground at Women for Climate in Paris. And Aisha Yunus is our social media superhero. Our climate expert consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King and Catherine Wilkinson. Our theme music is Water Fountain by Tuneyards with kind permission from 4AD and Marriage Records. And additional music is from Poddington Bear.